Hey, Phil, let go of my ego. Put aside the ego and embrace the moment.
Oh, for crying out loud. It's time for another midweek drive transcontinental adventure.
I was talking about waffles.
Well, it would seem it's not just the extreme evacuation of Afghanistan, which has caused an awful lot of things to be left behind, but actually on a different scale entirely. When British folk decide to actually leave and move home, we also leave an awful lot of things behind, although hopefully not weapons and various other aspects. In fact, it would seem that over half of British folk are actually absolutely rubbish recycling relocators and knowingly throw recyclable items in the bin when moving house. They actually just give up on the whole thing. So let's talk about this in slightly more detail and with the wonderful soul from Sustainable Packaging Campaign Group Beyond the Box, we welcome Andy Barmiston to talk about this. Andy, were you surprised by this or did you just think, yeah, well, you get to a stage where all those good intentions, all those good recycling things you've been doing, it just basically, when we move, we just leave everything behind?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show. Yes, so we were surprised. We're a small organisation founded to inform people about cardboard boxes, and that may not sound like the most exciting thing, but of course we need cardboard boxes when we move house and for many other occasions when we're not moving house for home deliveries. And we're trying to learn about people's recycling habits, and September happens to be the month when most people move, and of course not least with students going off to universities and to colleges. And we asked people, are you still recycling? And as you've said, sadly, more than 50% are just forgetting about recycling when they move. And of course, it's a difficult time to move house. Is one of the most stressful things you can do. And if you're moving off to university, you've got other big things to think about. But we're saying, please do remember recycling. You've used your cardboard boxes when you move. Once you've got them emptied, flatten them, recycle them, and get them back into the recycling loop. Because we need the old boxes to make new boxes. It's a good circular loop, but we need people to do their bit so we can keep it going.
Interesting that three quarters of those surveyed actually suggested that they were disappointed all councils didn't have the same recycling rules. I mean, that surprised me actually, because there's obviously if there's difference in terms of what different councils are actually offering, and I maybe can understand it, that could create some confusion, I would have thought.
It does. It does create confusion. That's quite right. Now, we would like councils all to do the same thing. It would obviously be a lot easier for everyone if they knew that the same coloured bin took the same material anywhere in the country. But sadly, it's not quite that simple. Local councils do have different things to think about. A council in the middle of a city is different from a rural region, and there's logistics and there's different issues. Which companies can they get the materials to? So we do understand that councils have a difficult job, but there could be a lot more consistency across the country. It could be a lot easier, and really, it's not rocket science. If recycling is made easier for people, then they will do it. And that's what people told us. As you say, two-thirds of people said, if you make the guidelines easier, we will recycle more. And that's what we need, a strong lead from government. And to be fair, the government department, DEFRA, is talking to industry and councils about how they can recycle more consistently. But we need the local governments to listen to the national government's lead, and it needs to be a lot easier than it is at the moment.
Showing perhaps that cynicism is beginning to creep in and maybe a kickback. A quarter of 18 to 25-year-olds admit they can't be bothered to recycle at all. I mean, do you think that could also have been impacted by the pandemic and so on, where people effectively have decided to become more nihilistic in their output on life?
It may be. We could probably discuss that one for hours, but we don't have time. I'm sure there's something of that in there. But it was a surprise because we're always told that the younger generation, the 18 to 25s, are the ones who care about the environment. They're the ones who know about recycling. And I don't doubt that for a second. But what we found is that that knowledge isn't becoming the behaviour. And I'd encourage everyone everywhere to do their recycling, but particularly if 18 to 25 year olds are saying we can't be bothered, please do be bothered, because we do need to recycle. There are many, many things that we need to do to benefit the environment, and recycling is one amongst many. And we should be doing the recycling because it really does matter. We need, as I've said, we need the old boxes to make new boxes. We need to keep the recycling going, and we need everybody to do their bit so we can make it happen.
The flip side, of course, is that for 25% who aren't interested, there are 75% who actually are. So perhaps there is an optimism line to actually take with respect to that. I mean, do you think progress is being made, or do you think, I mean, you know, clearly the fact that we're having this conversation, Andy, means that there's a long way to go. Do you think if we can dial forward, say, 5 years, do you think people will still be sort of working through this process, or when it comes to cardboard in particular, or we just sort of say, well, just let it go?
Well, with cardboard, of course, we've already got a great story. Everybody has the opportunity to recycle, either at curbside, or if that's not available for some reason, you can go to the local authority site. And cardboard has the highest recycling rate for any packaging material, more than 80%, 4 out of 5, 80% of all boxes that can be recycled in this country already are being recycled. And when you get a box, 3/4 of the fibre that's in that box has already been recycled. So we've already got a great story with cardboard. And of course, we can always do better. And we need councils to do their bit, and we need the consumers to do their bit, and we need, to be quite honest, for some other materials to try and catch up with our really good record, because we're leading the way. Where will we be 5 years from now? Well, I hope that government will have made some changes. I hope we will have more consistency. I hope we will all be much more keen to recycle and will recognise the importance of doing it.
And where can people find out more details, Andy, about the excellent work you're doing with Beyond the Box?
Thank you. Yes, Beyond the Box. We're online at cardboard.org.uk.
Andy Barniston from, indeed, the Sustainable Packaging Campaign Group Beyond the Box, BTB. Huge thanks. And may your boxes all be recyclable ones.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a year since the first child trust funds matured. They started 1st of September 2020, but since then, only half of the 500,000 teenagers eligible to claim their money have done so. So is this a case of free money? Well, let's find out. Let's talk to the Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Financial Mutuals, the wonderful Martin Shaw. How are you, Martin?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex. Thank you for inviting me on.
Absolute delight. Now, Martin, share with us. I mean, this does seem as though it's a case of, oh, you know, just leave that money there. Let's just do something completely different. I mean, is this the case?
Well, actually, if you look back at the history of child trust funds, they've been quite neglected for many years. I should probably give a quick history lesson, if I may. First of all, any child born between the 1st of September 2002 and the beginning of 2011 will have been entitled to have money from the government to set up a child trust fund. Now, in most cases, that money was provided by a voucher when the baby was born and sent on to the parents. And if the parents acted on that, they will have set up a fund with the bank or building society, or maybe with an investment company or friendly society to kickstart the child trust fund. Now, the truth was, not everyone realised that that was free money to get their child trust fund set up. So understandably, the child maybe hasn't been that aware of the money as it's been growing over the years. And what we've seen over the last 12 months is around 600,000 of those children born in 2002 and 2003 have reached the age of 18, and their money is now available to them through the Matured Child Trust Fund.
And certainly as we look to that particular age and we look at the onset, start of university careers, other areas, apprenticeships, things that could go in, that could really be vital in actually providing that additional support that families can benefit from, really.
Yeah, and the research we've done through Association of Financial Mutuals is that the average value of a child trust fund is £2,000. So not a small amount of money. And whether that's going to be used to pay for university fees or even driving lessons, or just built up in the future to save for a house deposit, whatever it is the 18-year-old needs to spend that money on, then that money is there sitting and waiting. And from our own research, we've identified that around half of everyone who has had a maturity hasn't actually done anything about that money. Now, the important thing to stress is that that money's not lost. It's still sitting in the Child Trust Fund waiting for them. But if the 18-year-old has a particular interest in saving in an ethical product, or perhaps looking at a lifetime ISA, which will mean extra government support to save for a house deposit, then they should be acting on that investment in the Child Trust Fund today to make sure that they can take full advantage of it in the future.
So it's really a case of not necessarily saying, yeah, we'll take the money out now and spend it. Obviously, you can do that, but actually looking at other alternative ways in which you can make your money work for yourself as opposed to other sort of areas. Is this just a lack of education, Martin? Is it a case of people have got so many things to cope with, and what with the pandemic, what with all the other sort of aspects, they've just literally forgotten all about this?
Yeah, you can perfectly understand that in the middle of a pandemic, a young 18-year-old will maybe not be that focused on a statement that comes through the post from an insurance company or a bank that they may not be aware of. It is partly about education. The whole idea of the Child Trust Fund was not just to provide money for an 18-year-old, but also to fuel their passion for understanding about financial services and their money over the course of their schoolhood. And unfortunately, schools have not had the time and the curriculum at the best of times to be able to devote to money matters. And of course, over the last 18 months, that's been made even more difficult. So you can fully understand why an 18-year-old who might be wary of posts that they weren't expecting might be dubious about the money that's come through to them.
Well, indeed so. I mean, certainly trust funds are a bit like children. They grow up so quickly and mature. It's quite amazing. Where can people go to find out further details about the Child Trust Fund and indeed the things we've been talking about today?
Well, first of all, they're very welcome to look at our website. That's financialmutuals.org, where they can find out about many of the providers that offer child trust funds. If they are in the right age group, or if they're coming up to the age of 18 in the next 12 months and they don't know where their child trust fund is, they should have a look at a search engine and type in Find My CTF. And through that, they'll be able to locate where their child trust fund now is.
Again, looking at that figure, 46% of CTFs remained unclaimed compared to 80%, which sat unclaimed following the months after the first full maturity last year. It's interesting times indeed. Martin, it's been fascinating as ever connecting with your good self. Keep on keeping on. Have a great day. And as Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Financial Mutuals, we support you. Take care now.
Many thanks, Alex. Good to speak to you.
One of the key words of advice I always give to my students when they're thinking about taking life-changing decisions or doing courses or indeed joining our course, etc., is to take the tummy test and actually see if it feels good. There is a slightly more significant and important aspect of the tummy test, though, which is what we're going to talk about today. And that's, of course, ensuring that our health is maintained. Is to actually talk us through this particular aspect, we're delighted to welcome, as ever, the fantastic individual who is Dr. Hilary Jones. How are you, Hilary?
I'm very well, and I hope you are too.
Excellent. And we've also got a wonderful soul who's actually had a wonderful narrative for our own perspective. That's Daksha Trivedi. How are you, Daksha?
I'm very well, thank you.
Let's turn to you first, Daksha. Share your own particular experience, because this is obviously going to be dealing with a fairly difficult topic to actually address in all so many ways. I tell you, the tummy test quite offhand, really. When we were talking about bowels, we're talking about all those kind of things. Share with us your own particular life journey.
Okay, so thank you. Thank you for having me, Alex. My twin brother died of advanced esophageal cancer, which had actually advanced to his stomach. His cancer was inoperable and he had the range of symptoms, and it was really too late by the time he went to see his physician with presenting symptoms. 6 months after he passed away, I was shockingly diagnosed with cancer of the lower esophagus, which is similar to what my twin brother had. So I was experiencing mild bloating, discomfort, diarrhea, which was unusual for me because, you know, we know our bodies, we know what's unusual. And I decided to see my GP. And fortunately for me, my GP was aware of my twin brother's inoperable cancer and that it was really advanced. Given the symptoms I presented with, which were mild, I must say I had mild symptoms, she referred me straight away to endoscopy. And I'm here and I'm alive 3 years later, you know, to tell the tale and to encourage others to go and get themselves checked out early.
And Hilary, this is really the key thing, isn't it? Early diagnosis, that prevention being a lot better than cure, or indeed being able to actually diagnose that there is a challenge in the first place.
Absolutely. This is part of the Help Us Help You campaign run by NHS England, supported by Public Health England too. And we want people to be aware of the early symptoms of abdominal and urological cancers particularly. These account for 44% of all cancers in England and 41% of all deaths. So I'm talking about bowel cancer, kidney, bladder, ovarian cancers. What people might refer to as tummy trouble symptoms resulting from these things. And we know that people are a bit reluctant to go and see their GP initially for all sorts of reasons. But if you've got abdominal discomfort or diarrhea for more than 3 weeks, or even if you've seen blood in your wee just once, you must go and get it checked out. It's probably nothing serious. There are many, many benign causes of those symptoms, but there will be some who do have early cancer. And the earlier we see you, the earlier we can get it treated. There are more treatment options and the outlook is so much better. So as Daksha says very eloquently, don't hesitate. Please go and see your GP. We're open for business and we want to see you.
It's quite shocking that nearly three quarters of the public said that they wouldn't tell friends and family if they had those kind of symptoms you've just described, Hilary, the notion of consistent bowel problems and other sort of aspects. I mean, is this just the stiff upper lip, basically, or carried to extremes where you just think, you wouldn't worry about if your car was giving you problems from that point of view, you'd take it to the garage, wouldn't you? So why not with yourself?
Well, it's a good question. The NHS England survey showed, as you say, that so many people were reluctant to worry their friends and family by being honest about what they were experiencing. Half of them said they'd even be embarrassed to talk to their symptoms about with their GP, or felt that they'd be wasting their time. And here's what really struck me as being significant. 71% of people said they'd only go and see the GP if they thought their symptoms were really serious, and yet a third of them didn't know what serious symptoms meant. You know, I've talked about some of them, but there are others as well, such as, you know, feeling bloated all the time, constipation for more than 3 weeks, feeling nauseous or sick, having blood in the motions, feeling a lump in your tummy, unexplained weight loss. All of these things are abnormal. They're not things you should normally have. And we want people to go and see the GP. And despite the pandemic, which initially understandably made people rather reluctant to go to the GP surgery or to the hospital, now we have secure, COVID-secure cancer hubs and methods of treatment, which mean you don't have to go to hospital as often. So it's safe and it's secure. And we really want to encourage people with symptoms such as these to go and see physicians and get it sorted.
And of course, you've also produced a fascinating film with Stephen Fry that kind of obviously demonstrates again this for people who wish to find out more details. Daksha, if I could just turn to your good self, in terms of what Dr. Hilary's been sharing with us then, and of course your own experience of surviving, you would doubt the sort of encourage people who are listening to this particular piece to actually say, look, don't mess about, actually get it checked out. And as the words go, basically help the NHS to help you, help us help you, which I often think actually reminded me of Jerry Maguire for some reason. Maybe it's a case of a different sort of line there. Still, Daksha, back to yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just going on from what Hilary said, in my twin brother's case, he wrote his symptoms off as if they were all non-specific. They're common symptoms. They happen to other people. And, you know, he missed that early diagnosis. So, you know, it's very easy for a patient to talk themselves out of going to see their GP. thinking that your symptoms are non-specific. Well, they may be non-specific, you know, tummy discomfort and all that, but they, as Hilary mentioned, they are unusual. They're unusual to you. They may be new to you. And again, persistent symptoms. Do not delay seeking help, because I'm a testament of where I am now, because I went early, I got detected early, I got treated early, and I'm here to tell the tale.
So, Hilary, back to yourself. Help us help you. It's a sequence between Jerry Maguire, played by Tom Cruise, and Cuba Gooding Jr., just in case you're wondering, what am I referring to in terms of help me to help you? Great movie.
Thank you.
Hilary, where can people actually go to find out more details about this campaign and more?
Well, a really good site is nhs.uk/cancer-symptoms.
It's been fantastic, as ever, connecting with your good self. You know the questions, Hilary. Have you had a recently interesting Zoomer with us, and will you come back again?
Of course I will. Look, this is such an important subject. Dash is fantastic to be sharing her experience with us, because people will identify with her. And you know, 100 doctors saying what I'm saying is all very well, but for a real person to explain, you know, her loss of her brother and talk about her own situation really has an impact on people. And hopefully together with NHS England and this campaign and Stephen Fry all pulling together, and your good self giving us publicity, I think we'll get there and get the message across.
Absolutely. Trivedi, Jones, Fry and Siren Radio. It's awesome. You know, fantastic stuff there. Daksha, a delight connecting with your good self. Keep on keeping on. And yes, again, help the NHS help you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hilary. And obviously, looking back over the importance of getting your bowels checked out. I know, featuring a bowel movement just after we've talked about the wondrous world of child trust funds and how they're maturing, etc. Well, it's a Thursday morning. It's kind of leading up to all sorts of other bits and pieces for the Siren Radio listener, for the podcast listener. Who knows what time of day it is, but it is time for that slot, which we refer to as Movies and Royals, and already in pole position. We've got Robin Pearce. Meanwhile, Richard Fitzwilliams has actually gone off in search of some H2O. So the question is, will he actually be back in time for me to actually talk about cinematic's most vibrant red coat since Don't Look Now? And indeed, following on from the big C, the fact that the movie itself is 84 minutes worth of a tribute to the late actress Nika McGuigan, who sadly passed away. That, of course, is Wildfire, which I think we'll actually have to come to after the other shocking news that Reminiscence, according to Empire magazine, something we looked at last week, was given 3 whole English stars out of 5, of course, from Lisa Joy. Snake Eyes was given 2 stars. But even more shocking from the point of view of the Empire team, Free Guy scenario was only given 2 stars as well, and was generally dissed quite badly by Empire, which I suppose just goes to show, Robin, that when it comes to the movies and such like, it's all about opinions and so on.
Indeed, and opinions are a great deal like bowel movements. Everybody has one.
This is so true. The Ten Rings will return. The Ten Rings shall return. Oops, end spoiler alert there. But Shang-Chi is there, or is it Shang-Chi? And is the magic of Doug Munch and Paul Gulacy, and the time when, of course, they opened up this whole wondrous world of the 1970s, following in the footsteps, of course, of Bruce Lee and Kwai Chang Kane, is it actually worth the next entrance of the Marvel Universe? And should Richard have actually considered going to see this as opposed to Pig, which you'll be talking about in the not-too-distant future? Before you answer, we say, welcome back, Sebastian. Are you feeling better?
Feeling a lot better now. If anyone's not had COVID, I don't recommend getting it. It's not very fun.
Yeah.
Good to see you. I'm glad you're feeling much better.
Thank you.
Sebastian, you're okay.
A lot better than I was.
Yeah. And just as well, Sebastian, because frankly, we couldn't actually be bothered dealing with a whip round for your funeral. So it's good that you're back in force. That's important.
Alex, what thought?
Before we go on to Robin's view of Shang-Chi, Natasha, I believe your sister has actually also been to see this movie. What did she make of it? What's her score?
Yeah, so my sister went to see it on opening day. She was really excited. She's a big Marvel fan too. Overall, she gave it a 8.5 out of 10. She said she really liked the action and the characters in it. She thought the plot was a little less good as the action. But yeah, thoroughly enjoyed the film, thought that it was funny in some places and would definitely recommend it to, you know, a wide a variety of people.
There you are, 8.5 out of 10 for The Next Generation. But Robin, as you were around back in the early days of Shang-Chi and all sorts of other areas where the son of Fu Manchu is sorting things out in so many ways, what are your thoughts on this movie, which again, shockingly, Richard has not checked out, even though I thought he was well ahead of all the Marvel Universe things? And how is he going to cope with the Eternals and next year's Multiverse of Madness with Professor Xavier returning?
Well, I mean, it's part of the fun of it, Alex, to see your response, you see.
Robin, what's your thought as a graphic narrative analyst extraordinaire?
Well, let's go back. To begin with, I thought Shang-Chi was a really weak choice to kick off what is Marvel's Phase 4. I know technically it's Black Widow, but we all knew the Black Widow from several previous movies. If you're introducing new characters, I thought Shang-Chi was a pretty weak one, because the whole history of it goes back to the early 70s, when there was the explosion in martial arts interest. It became a huge craze. Carl Douglas sang Kung Fu fighting. Bruce Lee was dominating the cinemas, while David Carradine dominated the small screen. And Marvel, who were in pretty dire financial straits at the time, were looking to hook into anything that could sell comic books. So they came up with a character of Shang-Chi, who was, back in the 70s, the son of Fu Manchu, a train killer, and he was out to basically undo the wrongs that his father, the famous Sax Roma character, had created. And I read several issues. I don't know what happened to the title, whether it went out of print when the craze ended or what. But I hadn't heard of him for years, decades actually. And it's coming up to about 45 years since I read those comics. So, you know, memory's a little bit sketchy perhaps. But I still thought, weak source to really kick off Phase 4. And how wrong I was, because this film is an ideal kickoff, see what I did there, for the new phase of Marvel films. Most people will never have heard of Shang-Chi. They've actually eliminated, this was my big worry, they've eliminated the whole thing of Fu Manchu being involved. They've brought in the Ten Rings. Now, according to Marvel lore back in the day, the Ten Rings were what the Mandarin, the Iron Man villain that we saw in Iron Man 3, wore on his fingers and thumbs, which gave him almost unlimited power, which he, as a humble Chinese peasant behind the Red Curtain, actually discovered in a crashed alien spacecraft. Okay, we've eliminated part of that in the film, in that he may have found him in a tomb, you know, we don't know, but Shang-Chi's father, who is now not Fu Manchu, is a gangster kind of guy called Zhu Wenwu, played by Tony Leung. Now then, he has been alive for over 1,000 years, and his Ten Rings organization have toppled governments, they've assassinated people. I mean, it's basically a huge organization based largely on crime. Shang-Chi is his son and is a trained assassin and has moved to America. He doesn't want anything to do with the old man's business. He's changed his name to Sean. He's got a few friends. He parks cars as a valet for a living.
Sorry, Robin, I just have to sort of line that there with a little tie-in. He's changed his name from Shang to Sean. And he
that is a joke
disguise
in the film, yes, which is made constantly by his friend Katie, played by rapper Awkwafina. he becomes embroiled in this, in the Ten Rings, when trained assassins come after him wanting the jade necklace he has. And he realizes that they'll be after the similar one that his sister has. From then on, the action comes thick and fast. Now, if you thought Mortal Kombat was a way over the top action epic, which it was, it just doesn't prepare you for the sprawling martial arts extravaganza that is Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. It successfully brings in martial art, wirework, special effects. It brings in crime. It brings in comedy. It brings in fantasy. It brings in myths. It brings in legends in a stunning
Is it as good as Mulan, minutes. Robin? Is it as good as Mulan?
I have never seen the live action. So I really can't tell you, but this
may I interject?
No, Richard. No, we know your thoughts on Mulan. Go away.
Well, this is a 2-hour, 10-minute film that actually feels like about 45 minutes. It brings in other Marvel characters. It sorts out a problem that I've always had with one of the original Marvel movies. And the villainy therein, so we get full disclosure on who and what the Mandarin from Iron Man 3 is or was.
It's not Ben Kingsley. Let's face it, Robin. He's not Ben Kingsley. Ben Kingsley is
in this film. Trevor Slattery returns. Yay! And has some of the best scenes and best dialogue in the film, in an already incredible film. It's just delight after delight after delight after delight. I mean, I really had a ball watching this.
Okay, Robin, stop watching it. Okay.
Hang on, two stings. You've got to watch to the middle of the credits, and then you need to watch to the very end, because they set up some of the big catastrophic things that are coming this way in the upcoming Marvel phases. And I, no hesitation, it's a 9. When I see it a second time, it may even be a 10. But right now, it is a 9. Don't question it. Go and see it.
And if only you'd actually taken the bus as opposed to actually driving your own vehicle in Manchester, you would have saved yourself all sorts of things, although possibly got involved in a bus fight. But never mind.
Oh, my goodness.
Sebastian, is this one you're looking for now? Is it a case of a post-COVID experience that you're saying, yes, I need some martial arts combat and mayhem with Shang-Chi?
I'm more interested in it than a lot of the others. Obviously, I have like pretty much zero interest in Marvel, but I'm a big fan of like a lot of the martial arts stuff that was coming out in the 70s. And Tony Leung, I think, is a really tremendous actor. So I'm kind of intrigued by the prospect of seeing him in some big Hollywood film, just even for the novelty. But I'm sure the action's probably worth it, so that might be enough for me.
And obviously, Natasha, your sister, not quite as impressed as Robin, but still, the Ten Rings will return.
Oh, definitely. If I can get out of this flat anytime in the next century, I would love to go and see it.
Now, I'm beginning to actually sort of move now into a system where if I actually just look very carefully through the magic of Zoom, I can actually see the spectre of Anne Boleyn actually sort of just whispering some thoughts into Richard at present about the Venice Film Festival and the fact that Spencer has effectively been awarded 5 stars with a seductive feast for the eyes with all the warmth of the lady herself. 5 stars.
The Daily Telegraph, absolutely. I have the review in front of me. As a matter of fact, Alex, and you're absolutely right to highlight this film, because obviously I haven't seen it, because previews at the Lama premieres at the London Film Festival on the 7th of October. I was discussing it on GB News yesterday, and we were doing a review of the Royal Week. And the interesting aspect of this, the Daily Mail, by the way, gives it 2 stars and says that it's bad. I haven't read the reviews. I'm just looking at the title, because I have no intention of indulging in these terrifying spoilers that I'm sure they contain. But what's interesting,
Richard, we know what happens to Diana in the end. It's not a spoiler. It's like the Titanic.
Alex, it's set in 1991 at Christmas at Sandringham, and the idea behind it is then that, and everything is going to be controversial, of course, on this, that Diana decides to leave Charles. So that also, Kristen Stewart, how good will she be? She'll be better than Naomi Watts, who was in Diana, which was absolutely excoriated. And also, of course, Emma Corrin, I thought, was excellent in The Crown, as Diana said. It'll be very, very interesting to see how this movie works. But Pablo Larraín, who directed it, this is the point of interest to me. Jackie, are you in agreement, Alex? A superb film, remarkable performance also by Natalie Portman.
Except this is not Natalie Portman, it's Kristen Stewart, who of course comes from a different angle and still actually managed to emote wonderfully. And Richard, I'm hopeful that we can actually get you to go along as part of a trio, because I'm looking for Meghan and Prince Harry to be accompanying you, because I think they should be first in the queue to actually see once again how evil and corrupt the institution of the royal family that actually sort of just dealt with Harry's mother can actually be portrayed on screen. But that's another line. Let's talk about
Idea, Alex. I mean, I'll bear it in mind, but I need the invitation to come from them.
Of course. I'm just putting it out there. As I said at the start, we have support and obviously a tribute to the late actress Anika McGuigan, who passed away in 2019 due to cancer. But does Wildfire, Richard, contain cinema's most vibrant red coat since Don't Look Now?
Well, yes, indeed, Don't Look Now. It's indelibly etched in my memory. That indeed is a feature of it, and it's one of my favourite films. I mean, as a psychological thriller, I think Nicholas Rowe's masterpiece with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie. I actually met Donald Sutherland at the London Film Critics Circle Awards a few years ago, a person of enormous physicality, and he was tantalising his audience with the idea. There was a particularly, it's a beautifully portrayed and fascinatingly cut sex scene in it, and he was having a lot of fun with an audience agog to know whether he'd let it's always been said that they were actually making love.
Richard, please, you know, it is Julie Christie. You just want to step away from that whole system and remember her role in Dr. Zhivago.
I do indeed, Alex, and I accept that is more your scene than perhaps Don't Look Now was. I'm sure you'll agree that Don't Look Now was a masterpiece. But yes, the red coat does feature, and indeed there are a lot of flashbacks in this movie, which are very, very meaningful. It's basically a celebration of bonds between two sisters. Both have been traumatized by their mother's death in a car accident. Yes, Kelly, who is played by Anika McGuigan, who very tragically died during post-production from cancer. She has gone missing. She plays this character who she's vanished. She literally just walks out. And we see at the beginning of the film, she actually arrives back in Northern Ireland. She takes the ferry, turns up at her home. And I mean, when she leaves, initially we learn, obviously her sister's absolutely devastated. And to what extent the sisters could get back together, you do wonder initially. I have to say that this is a movie, it does have some flaws in it, because initially Lauren, her sister, played by Nora Jane Noon, is resentful, as well she might be, considering what happened. The missing person turns up. But they're reunited rather quickly, I thought, given the way the script is handled. And then they take enormous pleasure in each other's company. But Kelly's behaviour, and that's unquestionably erratic, is resented by Lauren's husband, Sean, played by Martin McCann, who wants her examined by a psychiatrist. Now, this is a movie with a political slant. There are lengthy opening clips from the period of the Troubles. We learn that their father was killed in a terrorist bombing. Both are deeply emotionally scarred by their mother's death. Kelly's disappearance caused further shock. And what emerges from the flashbacks that constantly torment them both. That's the centre of this movie. Now, visually, I liked it. I thought very good performances. Nicky McGuigan, it's just too awful that she died so tragically. Very angst-ridden, unpredictable character, well acted. Nora Jane Noone, excellent as Lauren. She's coped with a lot of tragedy. Characters well portrayed. And also,
in the words of Marc Camoge, the actual performances lift out the whole piece. Whereas it's not just the director, it's the performances that work.
It's the performances that work. And also the film skillfully portrays a very gossipy, destructive nature of a small community. And I mean, the sisters escape each other's company or swimming in the river where you can't get artificial borders. But I did think that it is a flawed film. I wanted to get to know the main characters in more depth. They reunite, as I mentioned, I think far too quickly. It's also the case that Kathy Brady, the director, experiments with whirling cameras in a roadside scene where they have a fracas with a constabulary. It's unclear what's going on, and the device doesn't work totally. And climactically, the messages, which is implicit in the film, is driven home rather in a rather cliched way, I felt. But the bond between them, I mean, this is the scene that really shows how dramatic this movie and how superb it could have been. And that's where they dance together. It's a sort of feral bonding. And that worked superbly. That showed real passions. I think it could and should be have been more dramatic, but, you know, in a rather restrained way, I think it does have an impact. Yes, I rather liked it.
Given 4 stars, which is basically 8 out of 10 from Empire Magazine, presumably you'd say that's too high.
I would give it 3 stars, 3.5 stars. I thought it was good, but I did find some of it contrived.
Natasha, Wildfire, one for yourself, only 84 minutes, so you could probably fit it in 2 or 3 times, really, if you wish.
Just a few. I watched the trailer for this one. I think it would have to be one of those films that I watched when I was in a specific mood because it seems very intense. I see what Richard's saying about the dancing scene. That was really spectacular visually to see in the trailer. But I get the sense that it's not a particularly happy film throughout any of it.
It's about the troubles, Natasha. It's implicit, the Northern Ireland troubles.
Yes, so it might be one for when I'm in the mood for something a bit heavier.
Sebastian, one for your good self, perhaps?
I think so. I quite like sort of short. I mean, 85 minutes is pretty perfect runtime for a lot of films. And it sounds intriguing. I'd quite like a heavier
film. I'm still
film.
Shocked. Still a little bit shocked Richard hasn't actually decided to actually review the Amazon Cinderella, which also received 2 stars from Empire. But never mind, that's another line. Perhaps we'll come to that. Robin, what about your good self and Wildfire? Or is it a case of no, he was a character in the X-Men, other than that, we just don't talk about Wildfire at all?
Well, I hadn't heard about this film until listening to Richard right now. I'm undecided, to be honest with you. I might, like Natasha, I think I would have to be in a specific mood for something a little bit heavier for this, and it would fit that bill. But my normal mood, you know, way too away with the fairies.
Okay. Which, of course, could have actually occurred within the Troubles, particularly dealing with leprechauns. Though it delivers some entertaining comedy and bloodshed, it's clunky and overly instructive in its metaphorical purpose, killing subtext as often as it does anyone foolish enough to summon the eponymous spirit. Candyman, still actually given more points by Empire than Free Guy, 3 stars as opposed to 2 stars, but is Candyman also an expert choice for yourself, Robin? Robin, have you frozen on us?
No. You froze you see, there. You said the word.
Exactly. An expert on the whole notion of Candyman, and then you froze. Right. I've said it twice now. The third time is going to end it all.
A William Shatner pause there for dramatic effect, because I couldn't hear you. Hence my gesture. Anyhow, Candyman, I watched the original three films before going to this. So I was really looking forward to it as a horror fan. But I was a little bit wary of Jordan Peele's involvement because I liked Us up to the point where about 25 minutes before the end, he felt the need to explain the extraordinary events that we'd been witness to and were really quite creepy. He completely blew the Twilight Zone for me, and I'm a fan of the Twilight Zone. We covered that in Resonance Rewind, and frankly, before watching that film, I had it on my wish list of things that I was going to buy. It's been taken off. So Candyman, written, produced by Jordan Peele, directed by Nia DaCosta. Candyman to me, he is the black horror icon. The only one, as far as I'm aware. And as the legend stands, he is the perfect metaphor for Black Lives Matter. Because if you look back at the original legend that's set down by Clive Barker in the first film, the Candyman is the son of a former slave who created an invention, became rich. So his son was well-schooled, well-educated, well-cultured, made a fantastic living, getting even richer by painting the portraits of the rich and famous until he fell in love with the white daughter of a white sort of industrialist, rich guy. She became pregnant, and the father, of course, had him chased through town, where the Cabrini Green area of Chicago, where he was stripped, beaten, had his painting hand sawn off, a hook rammed into it for God knows what reason. He was daubed with honeycomb from nearby beehives, and he was stung to death. So that's the legend. And I thought, it's going to be interesting seeing what Jordan Peele, as a writer and producer, with his particular agenda, does with this. He rewrote the whole thing, needlessly. The Candyman in this one is he wore a long overcoat with a fur collar, like the original did, had a hook for a hand, and gave candy to kids. Now, as a former child myself, I have to ask the panel, would you take candy from a stranger who had a hook for a hand?
Okay, let's test that. Natasha, would you actually go along with that, or would your sister?
I'm on mute. Yeah, that's a big no. I don't talk to weird strange men with hooks for hands, even as an adult.
Okay.
Exactly.
And Sebastian?
No, I wouldn't.
No. Okay, that's fine. Yep. Point made.
What happened was that eventually this guy was giving out candy, and a piece of candy appeared with a razor blade in it. So he was the suspect. And he approached the child, who screamed. The police, who were looking for him, piled in and beat him to death. Now, this is very, very clumsy, because it's said in the dialogue, it's repeated in the dialogue, actually.
Was his name Rodney, by any chance?
No. It's he's beaten to death by the police.
George?
And the actual swarm of bees is said now to be a swarm of white police officers. So we are at that level.
Could this be a metaphor, Robin?
Well, this is my point, Alex. The original story as laid down in 1992, that is a fantastic metaphor that Jordan Peele needn't have bothered with. They further do the establish that the Candyman is basically any black guy, presumably wearing an overcoat with a fur thing and a hook, that gets beaten to death, basically persecuted, prosecuted, and executed by the evil white people. And it's uncomfortable.
Perhaps a little bit heavy-handed, perhaps? Just a little bit heavy-handed, or
it hook-handed? It is as an anvil on your big toe. It's very low on scares. The one thing that I found effective is that they summon the Candyman by saying his name five times into a mirror or a reflective surface. When he does appear and starts the slaughter, the cuts appear. The Candyman doesn't, but you can only see him in reflections.
Okay.
I thought that was quite effective.
Well, let's hold
low
it there.
What
score would you give,
three.
Robin?
Three.
Three,
and it's
okay.
Lucky to get that.
Sebastian.
I've not seen it, but I intend to. However, I've also not seen the original, which I'm more excited for, to be honest.
Natasha, it's not got zombies in, so possibly a bit too horrific for yourself?
Yeah, it's a no from me. I haven't seen the original either, sorry.
And Richard, despite it being a woke attempt, or an attempt at wokeness, it's a definite no. Thank the Lord we got Nicolas Cage, I hope, as a truffle hunter in your final choice, with a PIG moment.
Yes, indeed, and this is a second film, both of them excellent, I have to say. You remember some weeks ago we reviewed First Cow, and it's a second, because I think it's unusual for films to have the names of animals, and this pig is a very, very special pig. It's an extraordinary film. Who ever thought that the restaurant business could be quite as vicious and vindictive and dangerous as we find out here? Nicolas Cage, as you may well not have seen him before, looking very battered, I have to say, throughout the entire movie. I don't think there's a single scene in the movie which he isn't in. It's written and directed by Michael Sarnowski in an impressive debut. And Cage plays Robin Rob Felt, a former chef who had a big reputation once. It's contemporary, it's based in Portland, Oregon, but he lives in a cabin deep in the forests, and it's pretty clear that he's hiding from something. It's a memory that there's a voice on a tape which gives you a clue, a personal tragedy that has affected him. He hunts for truffles, and he uses his prized foraging pig. And he sells these truffles to a character who actually is rather interesting, I thought, called Amir. Very, very good performance by Alex Wolff, a rather complex figure and absolutely pivotal to this plot. And Amir supplies luxury ingredients to restaurants. But one night, Rob is assaulted by assailants who steal his pig, and he deeply, deeply affectionate feel toward this animal, and it's for this reason, entirely apart from the fact that Trump hunts truffles, that he intends to get it back. And he's not the sort of person you cross. He determined to get to Portland, even if his car breaks down, he'll walk there, links up with Amir. You could say that this is very unlikely, and I have to say that the elements of this plot probably are very unlikely. However, it makes a good story. It's very unusual. He starts a very dangerous trip underground. He's reliving his past life, and some of his acquaintances are decidedly, shall we say, strange. He gets beaten up at one point very badly, which means that his disheveled appearance looks even worse. One of the characters in the movie who worked for him once actually asks him, do you need medical attention? And you might be asking the same question if you look at the trailer or you see this movie. He is in far from happy state, but the point is he's determined. Who stole this pig? How can he get the pig back? And he meets Amy's father. Now, this is a good performance by Adam Arkin as a character who's a ruthless figure who runs a chain of restaurants and is definitely involved, as pretty well everyone he meets is with this disappearance. Cage is exceptionally good. I mean, it is a very extraordinary performance. It's someone who's hiding from part of his past, from a tragedy. On the other hand, he looks extraordinarily unkempt, very heavy, heavy makeup, but there's an integrity to the performance as well as a physicality. Excellent supporting cast. It's dramatic. It's full of surprises. I mean, I went along with this film. You could argue that that in real life events probably or almost certainly wouldn't happen in quite the way we see them portrayed here. But it makes a good story. And yes, I mean, I think 4 stars is a perfectly respectable rating for it, because it's an unusual movie. And also it has some very, very touching scenes. Absolutely no spoilers from here for me, other than the fact that Amy plays a pivotal part in the movie, as his father does, and everyone that Rob meets when he visits Portland appears to know or is involved in some way with the disappearance of this animal to whom he's devoted. This is also an interesting aspect, how you can be that fond of an animal, as well as the fact that obviously it's pivotal to his trade. An unusual, I'd suggest that if you like this sort of thing and you're prepared to stick with Nicolas Cage for this length of time, he's in every scene, you enjoy it.
Sounds like Death Wish crossed with Babe, Pig in the City. And actually, in terms of the overall notion of animals in movies, well, you've obviously got the 101 Dalmatians, you've got the eponymous Babe, Pig in the City, you've got the Cat People, you've got the Aristocats. There's a whole stack of movies out there. And I'm sure that the tragedy of the alpaca that sadly didn't actually survive the Men from the Ministry's cull recently will also be coming through. Natasha,
what about
you haven't heard
cats,
about the story.
You mustn't leave cats out. I think you were a devotee, weren't you?
The Aristocats and cats, of course. Exactly so. Natasha, is this one for you? Will you be seeking to see whether Nicolas Cage actually brings home the bacon?
Definitely. I need to know what's happened to this pig. This pig is adorable. If anything has happened to this pig, there will be blood. I swear there will be blood.
And Sebastian, are you interested in the escapades of Nicolas Cage and a pig?
I've seen this one, actually. And I think, yeah, I agree with Richard. I think it's a pretty phenomenal film. It's a very lonely, quite sad, but I really loved it. I mean, I'm a big defender of Nicolas Cage anyway, and I think he's just terrific. And I think, yeah, I loved it. I couldn't recommend it enough. I think it's one of the best films of the year.
And your score, Sebastian, would be?
Probably a pretty solid 9. I've only seen it the once. I don't know if it would ever touch a 10, but it's better than this sort of film should be, really.
Yeah. So there we are, higher than Shang-Chi. As scored by Natasha's sister. Robin, are you attracted to Pig?
Actually, yes, I am, because I like Nicolas Cage's quirky performances. I like the quirky films that he makes, and this sounds like a likely watch for me.
And that has brought us to the end of a quartet of suggestions, plus actually you could say quintet if you include Spencer, which Richard astonishingly didn't actually fly over to Venice to actually see. I'm surprised, Richard. You know, it's still, if you will hang out with those people at GBTV, etc., who knows what could happen there. I mean, Andrew
well,
Neil...
Well, exactly, but I was, on the other hand, at Hampton Court, and I would just like to mention to flag up this Golden Glory exhibition, because the Field of the Cloth of Gold, where Henry the VIII met Francis II in 1520, 500 years, and was celebrated last year, so the exhibition's still on. It's quite a show, and at least you go to Hampton Court and you don't have an imitation Henry VIII come to greet you. Thank God for that.
Very true. Richard, I have to say, when you were at GBTV, did you see the ghost of Andrew Neil around? Or did people not speak of him these days? Because he seems to have gone AWOL for like weeks.
According to the reports today, he may not be returning. It's certainly an interesting story. I agree. But if I'm asked to report...
Ever the professional, ever the consummate professional. Richard Fitzwilliams, Robin Pierce, Natasha Armstrong and Sebastian Mann, huge thanks. Good that you're back, Sebastian. Avoid the coronavirus. Happy continued lockdown, Natasha. Robin, likewise, enjoy life and keep watching the movies.